the moment I got to Mumbai, I just was struck first by the physical similarities of this city that's built to look like somewhere it's not. Bombay is very consciously modeled to be a kind of tropical London, and Petersburg modeled as a kind of new Amsterdam. And then digging a little deeper, it became clear to me that the sort of psychological space the cities occupy in the Russian and Indian mind is very similar. If you ask any Russian or Indian, you know, what is your west-facing city? Where is the city where the international trends come in to your country? You know, the Russian would say, oh, of course, St. Petersburg, and the Indian would say Bombay, now Mumbai. From that, I thought that was sort of the seed of the book.
There is a common theme throughout the book as to whether or not a Western model is needed for a city to become great and influential like these cities have.
That's right. I try to pivot at the end of the book. I want to describe the past, this world we begin with in the book in 1703 and continue through the Age of Empire, where the West is in ascent and the rest of the world is working to catch up to it, often through these model modern cities, to today's moment, where Asia is ascendant and has many things to teach the West, and also my hope that we can have some equal exchange. The book ends actually not in any of these Asian cities, but in a Chinatown neighborhood in New York City, where an Asian expatriate developer and architect have placed multi-level urbanist building that you see all over East Asia. This one has a fruit stand on the bottom, and then it has a restaurant above it. It's the type of thing you see in Tokyo or Seoul. In New York, you see this having been imported from Asia, and yet it fits New York like a glove. It's sort of a perfect urban form for this most urbanized of American cities, and yet New York learns it from Asia, and I see great hope in that.
We can't really discuss your book without talking about St. Petersburg or Leningrad, which is really kind of the model around which the rest of the book is written.
Yeah, I think it's very important to start the book there because that's really where this project of the instant modern city begins. And I think it's often overlooked, Russia, because it's populated by people with fair skin and blue eyes and blonde hair who worship in churches, is often interpreted as being a part of the West. And of course, Peter the Great would be thrilled to have people in today's world process it that way. But this was a very intentional attempt to join the West that really begins under his reign with the creation of St. Petersburg as a purposefully Western-looking city filled with purposefully Western-educated people and purposefully open to the West in terms of immigration and the import of foreign experts. That's why I want to start the book there. And at the same time, I think it's important for your Asian listeners and my Asian readers, the book will be translated into Chinese next year, to also see the Russian experience through this perspective of a country that attempted to westernize itself first before these efforts that get underway later on as we move farther east and are really being reinvigorated today in places like Shanghai and Mumbai, but also in places like Bangalore and Chengdu and Shenzhen and Chennai.
A very interesting connection between Russia and China historically, as the Communist Party had been under Moscow's wing for some time and taking cues on how to do things. The architectural patterns of a lot of their buildings followed the Russian model and other things, too.
Yeah, that's correct. The attempt to westernize Russia through model cities lives on in the communist period in different, it sort of ebbs and flows. There are westernizers and there are anti-westernizers throughout Russian history, including straight through the communist period. The Chinese sort of inherit this as well. In the periods when Moscow is embracing modernity and technology and change and global exchange, they're pushing the Beijing party in that direction as well. Of course, at a certain point, that whole relationship breaks down and each country kind of goes its own way. But it's important to see these as ongoing relationships.
Let's discuss some of the cities that you have in your book and a little bit about them. Mumbai in particular, or Bombay as it used to be known, is quite an interesting city and especially one of pride among Indians.
Yes, I mean, Bombay is where India meets the world, and it's been that for 150 years. And in this period we're in right now, since the reforms of the early 1990s, Mumbai today is really rediscovering many of its traditions. You have global companies flocking back to Mumbai, and you have major urban development projects. Mumbai, you know, has skyscraper projects going up. It has mega malls, and it has all of these satellite cities developing across the creek on the mainland of the subcontinent, but of course all linked to central Mumbai by the railroads that have defined the city really since the 1850s, when the first railroad in Asia was built in that city.
We can't ignore one of the other main cities that you discuss in the book, and a model, even though it's not directly in our Asian region, it is a model for much of Asia and the rest of the world, and that's Dubai.
Yes, I mean, Dubai is, you know, maybe outside of your broadcasting range, but it's certainly a major city in the Asian imagination and an incredibly important city, particularly for the business class and even the humble laborers of South Asia. There are more South Asians in Dubai than there are Arabs. There's, of course, this famous Indian joke that the best city in India is Dubai, but there is some truth behind the humor. Dubai, I chose because it's sort of superlative city, and all of them, you know, all the cities I've written about have sort of claimed that at a certain time, often in a very Dubai manner. I mean, Shanghai prided itself on having the longest bar in the world in the 1920s. Now, of course, Dubai, for religious reasons, will never host the longest bar in the world, but it has the world's tallest building and its most spectacular musical fountain, and these headline-grabbing projects like the indoor ski slope. All of these things, you know, we can maybe chuckle at, but they have made the city a household name. And moreover, it's an important business hub. It's not just, it's often described as the Las Vegas of the Middle East, but, you know, all the buildings of Las Vegas are just hotels, whereas the buildings of Dubai are financial offices and trading ports, all manner of economically crucial activity going on there. Really is a crossroads of the world and should be taken seriously.